WOSU Public Media podcasts are made possible thanks to listener support. All of our digital content, such as Snully Goster and the All Sides of the Ann Fisher podcast, depend on the generosity of listeners like you. You can give at WOSU.org or through the WOSU mobile app. And thanks.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Justice Department has asked a federal judge to issue an order preventing enforcement of a new law that bans nearly all abortions in Texas. The law bans abortions after 6 weeks and empowers private citizens to sue anyone who aids and or abets a person seeking an abortion. Jeremy Blackman covers health and politics for the Houston Chronicle. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
There's still a lot of misunderstanding about this law out there and what the Supreme Court did in its ruling on the law. It's been 2 weeks since the Supreme Court stayed its hand, basically, and allowed the Texas abortion law to go into effect. What's been going on in that time?
Well, basically, most abortions have stopped in the state of Texas. There are about 7 million people of reproductive age in the state. So you can do the math on that. It's really had a chilling effect here. We've seen a number of our neighboring states report increases in the number of calls to abortion clinics in Colorado, Oklahoma, New Mexico, all states where abortions are still accessible for people. It's had its intended effect, and we are really in procedurally some uncharted water right now, as you mentioned, with the Department of Justice's last request last night.
Can you give us a thumbnail of the law and how it goes toward banning abortions in Texas?
Yeah, so the law itself is very similar to the 13 other states, including, I believe, Ohio, who has banned abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected. Now, that's not really the medical term. Mm-hmm. That's a term that anti-abortion activists use to describe what is the development of cells that will become a heart. And that usually happens around 6 weeks. So it bans the procedure after about 6 weeks in the state. And what's unique here is that it allows anyone, virtually anyone, to sue an abortion provider or anyone who assists in a pregnant person accessing abortion. So it turns the enforcement from what is typically the state to private citizens. And that's what really has the courts kind of wrapped up in trying to figure out what to do with this.
It does not make exemptions in the cases of rape and incest.
That's right. And that's actually a trend that's been happening more recently in the anti-abortion movement. It used to be that many of these laws restricting access to abortion included those exceptions. And in recent years, a number of people in the anti-abortion movement have been calling for those exceptions to be removed. Both because it just doesn't align with their kind of ethical beliefs, but also what they've expressed to me here in Texas is that it doesn't really help them when they make an argument in court because it doesn't align with their goals of protecting the fetus.
No matter where or who.
No matter where, no matter the cause.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with a state government reporter, covers health and politics for the Houston Chronicle, Jeremy Blackman. And, of course, we're talking about the Texas abortion law. It went into effect. The U.S. Supreme Court let it go into effect. Now the Justice Department has asked a federal judge to issue an order preventing enforcement of the new law. If you have a question or comment coming up this hour, we're going to have a couple legal experts, a historian of abortion law in the United States as well. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Jeremy, the hitch is that it allows anyone to not enforce the law, but to sue on behalf of the law or by way of the law. That's the kind of the distinction, right? That's the importance. It doesn't. There aren't going to be. There's nobody from the Department of Health or nobody. Sheriffs and police officers won't go out and arrest people for violating the law.
That's right. I mean, the law specifically says that the state cannot enforce the law. And it does that so that it can get around these other states that have run into obstacles legally when they try to enforce these bans. And the trick here is that, okay, well, I forgot what I was
going to
say.
Well, I'm trying to think of like, they have to wait until somebody A sues, right?
Well, yeah, there's some contention there because the legal scholars that I've talked to, I mean, nobody really knows what's going to happen with this law. There's not much precedent for it, at least at this scale and, you know, allowing this many people to bring lawsuits. So the contention is that you actually need an abortion provider to defy the law in order to start a case that could actually get at the substance of the law. Because right now the Supreme Court in its decision has really said we're not making any judgments on whether or not the law is constitutional or not. In fact, we think, you know, it kind of seems like it may be unconstitutional, but this is strictly about procedure. And we don't right now see any means in which we can intervene in this law, because these are all about private citizens. So it's really right now trying to figure out who to sue to have an effective block of the law.
You wrote about the frantic final hours of in Texas before the law went into effect. People were waiting for that ruling from the Supreme Court. What was it like?
It was chaotic. And to be honest, I mean, this was not just the frantic hours. This was the frantic weeks. Mm-hmm. Abortion providers really saw this coming for at least a month that they expected the law to likely go into effect. And in that last week before it did, you know, they were working 12, 15 hour shifts trying to see as many people. Of course, the nature of abortion, it's you can't pre-plan procedures. So, but yeah, there was a lot of working around the clock. There was one clinic in particular that stayed open until the very final minutes before the law went into effect. That was up in Fort Worth. And at that clinic, you know, they had people waiting in their cars. They had activists who were against abortion in the parking lot calling the fire department, calling the police department, saying they were over capacity, trying to do anything that they could do to try to delay the procedures that were going on that night. So it really came down, I think the final procedure was at 11:57 p.m., like the final minutes before it clicked into effect at midnight.
And when we talk about aiding and abetting, that could that be me driving somebody to a doctor to get a referral to an abortion clinic?
Absolutely. Yes, the law is intentionally vague in that regard to who qualifies as an aider and abetter. And that could be an Uber driver, that could be, you know, somebody who gives you $100 to get an abortion. It could really be any personal contact.
It could be an Uber driver who unwittingly does it.
There's not really, we don't know. I mean, right now, potentially, yes, someone could file a lawsuit against an Uber driver. We don't know whether or not that lawsuit would be successful. But right now, there's nothing preventing it from being filed. And the sheer act of filing the lawsuit is really the goal here, because it then deters people from, we've had Uber drivers say that, I'm not going to drive anyone to an abortion clinic anymore, because I don't know.
Right. And I get that. But could they be driving somebody to a doctor's office?
Yes.
Where they get then the referral to the abortion clinic?
Potentially. Now, the thing is that the groups that are behind the law, Texas Right to Life is the biggest anti-abortion group. You know, its claim is that our intention is not to sue someone for driving someone to a doctor's clinic who's then referred to an abortion provider. That's not our goal here. Our goal is to simply stop abortions. And that was actually part of the debate with the law, whether or not it was harsh enough, because there's divisions in the anti-abortion movement. There are people who want to criminalize any procedures past 6 weeks, and they want providers in jail. This doesn't do that. This simply makes it legally and financially infeasible to provide the procedure.
And it does not, you can't sue the woman seeking the abortion.
Right. That's basically
why?
The only people who are.
Did they explain
well,
you why
talk,
that?
You're going to be talking to a historian, and you can talk about the differences and the goal here. But really, the point is that it's not popular to antagonize people who are seeking abortion. And so that has been a shift in the strategy. Right now we'll see, but we don't have anyone, the effect will effectively punish people who want to seek abortion, but it doesn't criminalize it.
You wrote an article explaining how the seed for the Texas abortion ban was planted 20 years ago in Louisiana. What about that?
Yeah, that was really, fascinating and something that has just been out there and none of us really were looking at it. It involved a law that passed in 1997 in Louisiana that effectively allowed patients who had received abortions to sue their providers for up to 10 years after the procedure for any sort of emotional, physical, or other trauma. And the Fifth Circuit, which is the circuit that oversees Texas as well, the appeals court, basically upheld the law on appeal. And that decision was never put up to the Supreme Court. And it is one of the reasons that led the chief architects of this law to think that the law could stand, because it involved enforcement being placed on a private citizen rather than the state. And that was the same problem they ran up in Louisiana.
Have there been any lawsuits filed yet?
Not to our knowledge. And that honestly is kind of intentional. If you have a lawsuit, as we talked about, then you're going to get at the substance of it. So this is actually an ideal situation for anti-abortion activists. Don't file a lawsuit, but the effect is to stop abortions, because providers are afraid that they're going to have thousands of lawsuits filed against them the minute that they start doing this.
Ergo, the chilling effect. Is there any concern that there might be some loose cannons out there in the pro-life movement that would file a lawsuit anyways, not understanding the intricacies of, you know, what the ultimate goal is?
Potentially. The thing is that was the expectation from abortion providers. When I talked to them a month before this law went into effect, they said that, you know, because the one avenue that they had is to actively protest the law. And they decided not to do that because they expected many lawsuits to be filed right out of the gate and to, you know, then argue the constitutionality as soon as that happened. It hasn't happened yet. I don't know if that means that there's a lot of coordination or that a lot of people just don't realize that they can bring a lawsuit at this point. But the law potentially allows people even outside of Texas to sue. Yeah, so it may be a matter of time, but we haven't seen a lawsuit yet. And the main groups, as I mentioned, Texas Right to Life, a number of the abortion providers have obtained temporary restraining orders against them filing suits. So even if they wanted to, they couldn't do it right at this moment.
So what the Justice Department did, it has launched this legal challenge. It's asked a federal judge in Texas to block enforcement of the state's new law. Given everything we just talked about, what's next? I mean, who's the judge and what do you expect?
The judge is the same judge who was overseeing the original lawsuit brought by abortion providers. His name is Robert Pittman. He had originally ruled favorably to providers, and that was all overturned by the Fifth Circuit. But basically, he said that providers could sue judges and their court clerks to prevent them from enforcing the law, because they play a role in adjudicating these lawsuits. That is the original federal lawsuit. The new lawsuit from the DOJ, he's also presiding over that. They filed this emergency motion. The state was originally supposed to respond by early next month. This potentially moves that forward. But any outcome here is going to be weeks out because it's going to be appealed to the Fifth Circuit and then potentially back to the Supreme Court. And that's really where everything is flopped here. Normally, the law is preemptively enjoined until it's decided whether or not it's legal. Here, it's allowed to go forward until it's decided whether or not it's legal.
And it's all kind of because the state is not involved in the enforcement of it.
Well, that, yes, and that's contended. I mean, the state says it's not involved in the enforcement. The providers are saying you do have a role.
Because they created the law.
Because you created the law, you pay the courts, you hire the judges. The law cannot be enforced without the state's involvement, is their contention.
Okay. Jeremy Blackmon, I'm going to be calling on you again. I hope you're around.
I'll be here. Yeah,
all right.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy Blackmon is a state government reporter. He covers health and politics for the Houston Chronicle. Coming up, we'll hear from some legal scholars and historian about this law and about, you know, what it means going forward for not just for Texas, but for all the red states that are where lawmakers are kind of chomping at the bit to mimic it, including in Ohio. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Justice Department is challenging the new Texas abortion ban and this week asked a federal judge to block its enforcement. Attorney General Merrick Garland said that the law is, quote, clearly unconstitutional, end quote, and could become the template for similar violations of other constitutional rights and judicial precedents.
This kind of scheme to nullify the Constitution of the United States is one that all Americans, whatever their politics or party, should fear.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at the Florida State University College of Law. Her 2020 book is titled Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Welcome back, Mary Ziegler. Okay.
I'm here. Thanks for having me. Sorry, just the mute button.
Okay. Welcome back, Mary Ziegler. Appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Mark Spindleman is a law professor at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Ann. Good to see you. Good to be with you.
You too. Let's start with the Supreme Court or what it did or what it didn't do that allowed the Texas law to take effect. Mark Spindleman, can you give us a thumbnail of that?
Yeah. So there was the case worked its way up to the Supreme Court and late at night, the expectation was that there would be an order from, the hope for some people was, the concern by others was that there would be an order by the Supreme Court, basically putting the law on hold as Jeremy Blackmon was describing. After what to many people, many court watchers, was a surprising delay in decision, the court issued a now very well-known order allowing the law to go into effect, but pointing out that it was reserving judgment on the underlying constitutionality of the measure, focusing in some of the ways that have already been described on the procedural dimensions of the law, but it allowed the law to go into effect. It didn't stop it and put it on hold as many people expected it would.
And that's because of the enforcement mechanism.
So this enforcement mechanism, what you just heard the U.S. Attorney General describe as a scheme, it effectively sort of made and raised questions about who it was that the Supreme Court would say, don't enforce the law. It's an unusual measure, one that has potential implications for other constitutional rights. But the court was, you know, sort of in this posture and and just would not move forward to put the law on hold. The move was one by the Supreme Court, was one that a number of court watchers saw and understood as a kind of foreshadowing of the demise of the abortion right yet to come in a major case that the Supreme Court is going to hear this this next Supreme Court term starting quite soon.
Which will deal with more substance.
Yeah, it's a different law from a different state. It's a law from Mississippi, but it goes right in a sense to the question about the Supreme Court's ongoing recognition for limits on the state's authority to regulate women's abortion rights.
And going to the point that Attorney General Merrick Garland made, that the Texas law is a scheme to nullify the Constitution, that has much broader implications than just regarding abortion rights. Right, Mark?
Potentially, sure. I mean, the idea here is if you can avoid these kinds of pre-enforcement challenges successfully, then these are sort of ways that other could be written into other laws limiting other constitutional rights that would effectively allow for the rights not to be meaningfully recognized and respected on the ground.
How much of an uphill battle does the Justice Department face in trying to stop this law from being enforced, Mary Ziegler?
I think there's quite, it depends, I think, in part on whether or not we're going to see anyone violate the law. So in Texas, at the moment, abortion providers have announced that they're not going to perform procedures after the sixth week of pregnancy, which is when Texas has introduced its ban, in part because if they do, they would face, you know, potentially having to pay at least $10,000 to each person who sues them for each abortion performed. It would be easier to bring a challenge, as Mark mentioned, if we knew who was enforcing the law, right? If there was such a plaintiff in such a lawsuit, there would be a court actually holding a trial, you know, issuing a damage award, enforcing a damage award, and the identity of the people to be sued would be much clearer. It's not hard to understand why we're not seeing that, because the potential for ruinous legal liability is real, not only because of these $10,000 payments, but also because the statute makes it very hard for people who are being sued, potentially unjustly, to recover their attorney's fees, even if they win. So the incentive structure is to incentivize everybody to sue and incentivize no one to perform abortions or help people who are doing abortions.
Wait.
So I think that's one mechanism. And that's one of the reasons that the fact that that isn't happening is one of the reasons the Justice Department stepped in.
I'm sorry. I just want to be clear that it's in the law that the defendants in such any potential lawsuit cannot recover their costs, even if they win.
Yeah, the definition of prevailing party in the statute is extraordinarily narrow. So if a court finds any of your claims are moot or if you win on 95% of your claims and lose on one, you can't recover attorney's fees. And that's unusual in the civil rights context. It's worth saying that under federal law, there's if you bring a civil rights action and win as the prevailing party, you're usually able to get attorney's fees. And that's precisely, I think, one of the major reasons Texas passed this law, because just recently it had to fork over $2.5 million for losing Holman's Health versus Hellerstedt, the last major Texas abortion case to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's absolutely a central dimension of the law.
The $10,000 seems arbitrary, Mark Spindelman. It doesn't matter, right?
It's a lot of money. I mean,
but the amount is just kind
and
of.
And it's not arbitrary either for what it's worth.
Okay.
Texas's in the maximum penalty you can receive for a felony in Texas law is $10,000. So what they were trying to do was to say we would criminalize this and treat it as a felon if we could, but we can't. So we're going to penalize it as much as we can. And in oral histories I've done with the people who wrote SB 8, they also said that they thought the higher the damage award, the more seriously they would be taking, you know, what they see as the protection of fetal life. So it's designed to be treating abortion as serious as a felony, not punishable by death under Texas law.
Yeah. Mark Spindelman?
For sure. I mean, Mary sort of describing on the ground sort of what the reality is about why they picked the amount, but clearly it's a very significant amount that that operates to have a significant deterrent as well as an expressive effect.
Charles in London, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to point out that no one has really exposed the fallacy of the anti-abortion argument that the government has a right to put a physical burden on the human body for the purpose of preserving life. If you intellectually take that position, then you have to require the government to also mandate postmortem, organ and tissue donation, living bone marrow and blood, bone marrow screening and blood donation. And because the liver can take up to a quarter of it and you can regenerate it, that's partial organ donation. So if that's what the government can really do is preserve life by putting a physical burden on the human body, and you stay through that, you have to also advocate for prenatal care and concerns around that. And I think that by not bringing up that context, we allow the argument get twisted about life, which everyone is in favor of, but whether or not the government has the role in putting a physical burden on the human body to preserve the life of another. And I'll take my answer off the air, and thanks for taking my call.
You bet, Charles. Mary Ziegler, has that issue popped up in the realm of law?
And not as much, in part because of really social movement strategy. So the people who are doing this litigation on the anti-abortion side don't agree on the issues that Charles raised, right? So they don't all agree on whether you should have that kind of obligation when it comes to something like organ donation. And so to maximize the odds that they can win on abortion, they don't talk about that. And they don't talk about other issues that you may see as life issues, like the death penalty or neonatal care after birth, or even what used to be called welfare rights was often called the right to life for the poor. Those are all issues on which people who are opposed to abortion don't agree, and that's seen as a kind of detriment for the movement. So they don't tend to talk about that at all. And that leads to, I think, a kind of disconnect between how a lot of people think about what's going on here and the kind of legal and political discourse we have.
Susan in Omaha, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi. My question is, could providers recruit someone to invoke the law, and then they'd have some standing to challenge it?
Yeah, Mark.
Like your guest said, that this is, you know, as long as nobody invokes it, they can't do anything.
Exactly. Mark Spindleman, what about that?
Well, I mean, I think as Mary was describing before, once you actually have some proceeding, then presumably there is an opportunity for courts to figure out who to say not to enforce the law. Susan's question raises, some potentially not uncomplicated issues around, doing an end run, a collaborative end run, a collusive end run around the ordinary ways in which the law would operate. But the thought is, presumably at some point there will be some challenge, although, if people are really just not providing the services, it's harder to imagine how that happens. But here we have, as you were describing before, and the federal government already having moved in to try to put a halt to the law, and we'll have to see what happens there and whether we have to wait much longer before there is some response to that federal government action.
Okay, so I'm still trying to understand what the Supreme Court didn't do. Couldn't that affect the federal judge's response to whatever the Justice Department has asked them to do?
I mean, I think so, yeah. I mean, I think there's also just the challenge for the federal government, a similar challenge in the sense that until someone enforces the law, it's not clear who the federal government should be suing either, right? And so the federal government has issues that way, both in terms of who it's suing and whether it has a concrete injury until someone is actually bringing a lawsuit. So I do think that that could influence how federal judges see some of the procedural aspects of the case.
Huh. What do you think, Mark?
I think that when the federal government is coming in and sort of being as careful as it has been, both to explain, what the general interests are that are at stake, its own concrete interests, that it may change the calculation. Certainly there's going to be a high degree of mindfulness of what happened before at the Supreme Court. But I take it that the federal, the U.S. Department of Justice's intervention in the matter changes some of the balance, and that some of the judges may see that change in balance as enough to provide some occasion for intervening.
Justice Elena Kagan, in her dissent, wrote that the Supreme Court ruling, quote, illustrates just how far the court's shadow docket decisions may depart from the usual principles of appellate process. What's the shadow docket, Mark Spindleman?
So the shadow docket is basically this idea that there are the cases that we see sort of in the news that are the, I guess you'd call them maybe the daytime docket or the bright light docket. Those are the kinds of cases and decisions where everything sort of happens in this, you know, sort of very ordinary way. But there are these sort of details of a procedure at the Supreme Court involving, like in this case, issuance of stays that, you know, sort of are part of what has recently been described as the shadow docket. It's just a different part of what the court's business is that, you know, sort of often it's about procedural matters. It can be highly technical in different instances, perhaps including in this one, rather than involving what are described as judgments on the merits of the case. In this case, the constitutionality of the measure, rather than the sort of complicated procedural legal questions of who can be sued, who can be enjoined, and those sorts of questions.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds nefarious when they use the phrase shadow docket, but it's not new.
No.
I think what's new is how it's being used, right? Okay. So I think historically the shadow docket used to be for sort of usually not very important things, right? It would be like people are filing a brief and they need an extra week to file the brief, and that would be handled on the shadow docket. It always was used for emergency petitions involving the death penalty. But during the Trump years, you saw both a radical increase in the number of shadow docket petitions and in how meaty or controversial they were, right? So we're talking about things like, you know, the border wall and COVID stay-at-home orders and religious liberty and abortion. And so the court is increasingly using the shadow docket to transact business that's important and divisive and substantive in a way that isn't new. So it's not what isn't, I think what's come in for a lot of criticism is not that there is a shadow docket, but that the shadow docket is playing a role that it didn't used to, and in ways that may be shielding the court from scrutiny when it does things that are, you know, not very well reasoned or that are unpopular.
We're going to take a quick break. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That is Mary Ziegler. She's a professor at the Florida State University College of Law. Her 2020 book is titled Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Also with us, Ohio State University Moritz College of Law professor Mark Spindleman. We are talking about the Texas abortion law that went into effect last week. And now is the topic of a Justice Department challenge asking a federal judge to block its enforcement. Questions or comments about what this means? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the legal ramifications of the new abortion law in Texas. It bans most abortions after 6 weeks and empowers civilians to sue anyone who aids or abets a person seeking an abortion. Still with us is Mary Ziegler, a law professor at Florida State University Law School. Her 2020 book is titled Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. And also OSU Moritz College of Law professor Mark Spindleman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Of course, we're not talking about whether abortion is good or not. We're talking about the Texas law that bans it, most abortions at 6 weeks, and empowers civilians to sue anyone who aids or abets a person seeking an abortion, and what kind of ramifications that can have in other states, including Ohio, where a similar law, at least a similarly restrictive law with different enforcement, has been stayed for now. Mary Ziegler, we've all read that the Texas law could be a blueprint for abortion legislation in other GOP-controlled states, including Ohio. Is it that simple?
It might be. I mean, the only thing we have to wonder about is if there's a sort of unique backlash to the enforcement mechanism. So just one powerful example, my governor, Ron DeSantis of Florida, had initially been one of the Republican governors to come out and say that he wanted to use the Texas law as a blueprint. And then just this week, his spokesperson came out and said actually that he was not interested in the bill, not because he was opposed to the abortion component of it, but because he didn't want to turn neighbors against one another. And so I think there's been a backlash to the Texas law, not only because of what it does about abortion, but because of what it would mean in terms of how the law is going to be enforced, right? Realistically, how is anyone going to know if anyone is performing an abortion, or in particular, aiding or abetting an abortion, right? That means anyone who helps. That could be anyone from a friend, a family member, someone providing transportation, someone donating to an abortion fund. And the law really incentivizes people, and people who frame the law have said as much, to report on one another. And I think that's making some people uncomfortable, including people who are Republican and people who are opposed to abortion. So exactly whether this serves as a blueprint or not, I think will depend on whether Republican lawmakers are more attracted to the fact that this may allow you to ban abortion without a fallout in the Supreme Court, or whether they're more disturbed by the bounty aspects of the bill that can be unsettling to their constituents.
Mark Spindleman. I was wondering, as far as using it as a blueprint, and Mary Ziegler saying, well, not everybody is in agreement that this is the right way to go about this, even though it may stop an abortion from ever taking place in Texas again, at least a legal abortion.
So Mary was really putting her finger on and helping to illuminate some of the political reasons why even in this context, those who are committed to the right to life and right to life legislation might not want to replicate the measure. Part of the significance of the legal challenges involving the Texas law will undoubtedly be sort of providing legal responses to the permissibility of measures like this once the right parties have been identified. At that point, presumably, we'll have a better and clearer sense about the legal permissibility of measures like these in cases going forward. So, it seems useful and expedient in the short term, but in the longer term, the mechanism, or what Attorney General Garland was describing as the scheme, may not hold up.
Yeah, Mary Ziegler, I mean, can you imagine any other, given what Merrick Garland said, any other constitutional rights out there that would fit this template?
I mean, if the court is seriously going to sign off on this sort of thing, there's nothing really stopping any legislature from introducing an enforcement mechanism like this for any right. It could be the right to bear arms. It could be the right to free exercise of religion, the right to freedom of speech, which is, I think, part of the reason why it's sort of hard to imagine the court eventually letting this go into effect, because either the court would have to do so very selectively and, you know, essentially treat abortion as if it isn't a right, which the court may ultimately do this year in a Mississippi case. But if not, then it's hard to imagine how you could have legislatures all across the country nullifying all kinds of constitutional rights without consequence, particularly when it's supposed to be the Supreme Court that interprets. Other popular actors are allowed to do so too, but this would essentially circumvent the Supreme Court altogether.
And do you think that's the Supreme Court? I mean, Mark Spindleman, the Supreme Court, it's cutting itself off at the knees then?
Look, I mean, it's, you know, you never want to sort of needlessly venture predictions about what the Supreme Court will do. But, you know, there's also just a kind of principle of reason or reasonableness that's at stake here. And so I think that the potential threat of schemes like these to a full range of constitutional rights that the American public enjoys suggests, at least to me, that the likeliest outcome, without venturing any hard prediction, that the likeliest outcome seems to be, you know, sort of in the right case to say the state doesn't get to basically insulate itself against legal challenge by you know, pretending or claiming to wash its hands of enforcement. It's still state law that's doing the work of effectively depriving people of their constitutional rights. And the expectation would be within our constitutional system that focuses on states' obligations not to do that, that, that these measures will likely fall. But, you know, there's a possibility that they won't, but we'll see.
Well, I guess then, given the structure of all of this, how do you get to that question? Who gets to it?
I mean, the courts will get to it. They just have to wait for the right parties. The courts are not, in a sense, you know, sort of actively going out and searching for parties and cases to decide. The right cases have to present themselves to the court. And part of what, at least on one understanding of what the Supreme Court did in the Texas case, was to say, we just don't have the right parties and the right posture before us. But the federal government's intervention is a way of seeking to sort of change the equation and to press the issue forward so that the courts are able in a different posture to get to the questions.
When it's had this chilling effect, though, Mary Ziegler, how do you find someone withstanding to press the point?
Well, I think there are two ways it could happen. I think one is that some abortion provider is convinced to bring a test case, notwithstanding the fact that there are legal potential liabilities that could flow from that. The second is that there's someone who's going to be doing quote unquote aiding or abetting, right? Trying to help a friend or loved one or acquaintance get an abortion out of state, who quite simply will be caught for doing that and sued, who may not want to be brought into the legal process, but who just wants to find an abortion and is reported on by someone else. If that happens, there could be a case that would go up to the court really regardless of whether people are interested in bringing a challenge. So I think you could have a kind of more deliberate attempt or a more unintentional attempt, but I think one way or another we'll eventually see some kind of challenge that comes to the court that way.
Okay, so you've enlightened me on something. If somebody seeks an abortion outside of Texas, anybody inside of Texas who helps them do even that would fall under this law.
It's a little complicated. If you have the abortion outside of Texas, you may not fall under the law. But let's say that, so it would depend on if the aiding or abetting is deemed legally to have happened in Texas.
Okay.
And if the abortion happens in Texas, the most likely way that would happen would be if somebody orders abortion medication on the internet or for someone else, and then that person takes the pill in Texas and ends the pregnancy. The person doing the aiding or abetting then could be in trouble, even if potentially, and the Texas law doesn't even explicitly say the person doing the aiding or abetting needs to be from Texas, as long as the abortion is taking place in Texas. So that's the kind of thing that could happen. If the abortion is happening out of state, it's not clear that the law
life. Yeah, I wondered if abortion medication, the abortion pill or whatever, would fall under all of this. And you're saying it does.
Yeah, I think anything that counts. Texas law, just to tighten it up, is Texas lawmakers are also introducing a bill that prohibits people from distributing abortion medication after the seventh week of pregnancy. But the law purports to apply to any abortion procedure that happens after 6 weeks, including medication abortion, which would probably be the most common method that you would see between the sixth and 10th week. So I don't see why. I mean, any way you have in that window after 6 weeks, the law seems to cover.
The way this is being done in Texas, would it have to be spread across the country in state law, in state after state, by way of separate law, in order to do away with Roe v. Wade, or would to do away with effectively do away with it, or would there have to be some kind of ruling at the federal level, Mark Spindleman?
Well, I mean, you know, you had the kinds of practical political problems that Mary was describing before that might keep this kind of approach from spreading across the country as quickly as some people might have feared and others might have hoped. The more likely route is a more direct route of cutting back on or overturning Roe against Wade, which either through challenges to the Texas measure or in the Mississippi case that we've mentioned before, that's before the Supreme Court, that is an option that's formally before the court.
The Ohio's so-called heartbeat bill has been stayed, right, Mark? I mean, that's just set aside at this point. If they amend, hypothetically, could they amend that law in Ohio and take on the Texas?
Hypothetically, sure.
They could. And
I mean, you just have to, like, you'd presumably have to repass the law, but right. You know, sort of, there might be questions about, you know, sort of what the scope of the earlier order is in relation to that measure. There might be sort of other kinds of collateral legal questions that developing in Ohio would involve.
In her dissent of the Supreme Court's ruling, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that, in effect, the Texas legislature has deputized the state citizens as bounty hunters, offering them cash prizes for civilly prosecuting their neighbors' medical procedures. Has there been any other kind of deputization of the citizenry before Mary Ziegler, do you know?
I mean, the example most people point to is both during the Jim Crow and slavery era, there were cash and sometimes, trade like tobacco-based incentives for people turning in fugitive slaves or people who were viewed to be fugitive slaves. More recently, there have been progressive, often kind of whistleblower legislation that incentivizes people to report on corruption by giving them a cut of the damages that would evolve. And more recently, on the conservative side of things, we've seen this strategy take shape both in at the city level, where cities are trying to ban abortion, the so-called Sanctuary City for Life movement, and also in instances in which conservative Christians are trying to provide religious liberty for people who are accused of discriminating against LGBTIQ folks. So one of the templates for Texas's bill is the so-called Save Chick-fil-A bill in Texas, which allows people to bring lawsuits if they are either discriminated against on the basis of their religion or they feel that they're about to be. They can bring a civil lawsuit and collect attorney's fees. And this was designed, again, to protect Chick-fil-A, which had been excluded from the airport in San Antonio for its donations to groups with anti-LGBTIQ donation policies. So we've seen more recently conservatives take up these bills, not just in the context of abortion, but in the context of the clashes between the intersection of religious liberty and protections for the LGBTIQ community.
And how does it hold up?
There haven't been that many challenges yet to the Chick-fil-A bill. In part, it's a recent bill, but in part because it's narrower. I mean, SB 8 and the Sanctuary City for Life bills on which it's based are just much broader in terms of who can sue. Usually, these kinds of bills on the progressive side, with some whistleblower exceptions, were deputizing people whose rights have been violated. So the kind of true bounty bills, right, where the person has absolutely nothing to do with anything, are less common and have been less recent and are more controversial because they don't really fit our common sense as to who should be able to sue, right? These people don't have injuries, they don't have anything to do with anything, and yet they're still getting to collect money. So it incentivizes a much broader and more troubling group of people to try to get involved, and it has a much darker history than some of the other legislation we've seen on the side of private enforcement.
We just have about a minute, Mark Spindleman. Anything you want to add to that? It's fascinating.
Now, I guess the thing that I want to say is, yes, to everything that Mary was saying, but more broadly, I think it's really important, as important as everything that's been happening in Texas has been and will continue to be, there's also this other case that's presently before the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court is going to be deciding what the ongoing meaning and scope of constitutional abortion rights looks like going forward. And that's an important dimension of the larger story of reproductive rights that this is all a part of. And so to make sure that people understand to keep their eyes on this, this Mississippi case and the challenge to the Mississippi law, even as we're thinking about and talking about the really very striking realities of abortion rights being restricted and constrained on the ground in Texas.
That's Mark Spindleman. He is a professor of law at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Thank you so much for your time, as always, Mark.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be with you.
And Mary Ziegler, professor at the Florida State University College of Law, author of the 2020 book, Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary Ziegler, thanks so much for your time, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.